I'm an actor in Los Angeles. Well, I like to say call myself student-actor, even though Peter Dinklage told me that no matter if I'm in school or not, I'm an actor. So I keep that with me at all times.
I'm Victoria Perot.
And I'm Amanda Whiteley.
And this is Coaching Shakespeare.
Thank you for tuning into Coaching Shakespeare. Each episode is devoted to a different tool lovers of Shakespeare can use to approach working on his speeches. In this episode, we explore a tool brought to us by one of my former students, Perenya Shilyert. She's currently studying theater at the University of Southern California. And Peren first explored this exercise that focuses on the sound of the words during her summer session at BADA, the British American Drama Academy, in Oxford, England. When she was a junior in high school, she went over there. Amanda, you did that program. Do you remember this exercise?
Yes, I do remember a version of this exercise because this was a big thing for them over at BADA. And the version that Eunice taught me involved closing your eyes and enjoying dark chocolate, which I just think is such a great entryway. Like really focusing in on your taste buds and the shape that your mouth is forming and using your mouth to taste the words. And we were talking to Peren a little bit when we were discussing this episode about the different purposes of words. Most of the time we often use words as tools for communication. They're signals that mean something. But regardless of what the definition is, words are inherently an experience.
As a voice and speech teacher, I'm always thinking about all the different aspects, cadence and rhythm and tone and production and delivery and intention and pace and, you know, to all the stuff that you can manipulate and explore in order to change the sound. But then that gets me to, what does sound even mean? Because if we shift intention, it's going to shift sound. What comes first? Intention, sound, sound, intention? Because that's what we're going to look at today. All right, so next to me is my new rescue pup. Mm-hmm. We've got this new dog a couple of weeks ago, and we're teaching it basic commands. So a word like sit, incredibly simple, monosyllabic sound. But it's totally dependent on how I say this word. I can say this harshly. I can say it gently. I can say the word sit to a guest I've invited in my home, and it can be incredibly warm. Or I can have a bunch of rowdy kids walk in my classroom and be out of control, and I tell them to sit, right? So if I'm talking to Q-Roy, this dog, I'm going to say, sit. And then if you come over, Amanda, I'm going to say, sit, sit. Mm. And I don't even have to say, make yourself comfortable. I just have to say, sit. And then if the rowdy boys come in, I'm going to say, sit.
It's so interesting watching your face change as you're saying those things too. I think it's very similar to the way that if you smile, your neurons immediately produce an effect of happiness. Like it's an external to internal thing. And oftentimes saying words, you know, regardless of their intention, has a physiological effect on the emotions that are going on inside.
Ah, okay. So that's the other way. And then the intention is going to affect how you say it, which then is coming back at me and affecting me physiologically. So as I started to picture that rowdy group coming in and saying, sit, and my whole body has changed. But then when I think of you coming to the house and I say, sit, sit, I feel completely different. But I'm still making the s-it sound. So it's complicated. And when we work with Peren, we're going to look at, is it the sound that gives way to the feeling? Is it the intention? We're really going to take that apart in this episode.
And I think an interesting distinction to make as well is, what role does phonetics play in this? What role does the phonetic pronunciation of a word play on its emotionality? You know, like saying the word sit is an inherently different thing than saying, I'm trying to think, pop a squat. You know, if I say pop a squat, that's totally moving my body in a different way than sit. The plosives totally change it. Like, you can't really slide into a pop a squat in the way that you can kind of slide into a sit. But pop a squat is like, it requires a bit of immediacy. It jumps your body a little bit.
That's what we're going to talk about. It literally tells you how to say it. Pop a squat. It's just in there.
Yeah, this is something I always think about, the musicality of words and the musicality of language. And I always have to take a step back when I find myself fighting the musical notes that are already there. If I was trying to make pop a squat legato, that would just feel so weird to me. But leaning into the pop a squat, it's like playing a piece of music with an instrument that it was written for, rather than playing heavy metal with a piccolo. It's something that's just, it could be done. I could say pop a squat with a lot of legato, but it's fighting its natural tendency.
Yeah. So Amanda, from pop a squat to Perenya Shilyurt. So Peren's going to take us through a few verse lines with her Saint Joan La Pucelle. This is a very chewy speech. Welcome, Peren. We are so excited to have you on the pod today. This is your exercise. I reached out to you. I asked you what you wanted to bring to the show. Tell us about yourself. Tell us what you're working on and then how you came to encounter this particular tool.
Yeah, of course. As you said, my name is Peren. I'm an actor in Los Angeles. Well, I like to say call myself student-actor, even though, fun fact, Peter Dinklage told me that no matter if I'm in school or not, I'm an actor. So I keep that with me at all times.
Peter Dinklage?
So when I was interning at Red Bull Theater.
Oh my God, we discussed this, didn't we?
No, I don't think we hit Red Bull.
Oh my goodness.
You also did Red Bull?
So senior year at Bergen County Academies, every Wednesday, the seniors go to an internship all day. And Amanda, you started the Red Bull internship.
Yes, it's classical theater and it's a nonprofit that just does phenomenal work. And their alumni and their network of actors is so impressive.
But tell us about Peter Dinklage.
Yeah, so this was after the internship. But Jim was like, we're doing a gala. I know you technically don't like work for us anymore, but like you're so welcome to come and help out and like do whatever. So I was like, yeah, it was like a Saturday. I took the day, I went into the city. I helped them set up. And Peter Dinklage's wife was the one who directed her modern adaptation of the Scottish play. Peter Dinklage was at the gala, of course, and all the actors are friends with him. And I was sitting in the back, and Peter Dinklage like came out of the bathroom, was talking to one of the people behind the bar, and he saw me and just like walked up and started talking to me. And I talked to him about Game of Thrones, said I've never seen the show, and he goes, "Cool, me neither." I was like, great. I think he said he's seen a couple episodes, but I remember him distinctly saying, it's too long. Like, I cannot get through it. And I was like, that's okay. And I told him I'm an actor, but then I said, oh, but I'm in school right now. And he was like, in school, out of school, you're still an actor. That was the Peter Dinklage story. So, yes, I'm currently in school. I was recently cast in one of my school's productions. All of our stuff is on Zoom now, all of our student theater shows, as well as the main stage department productions. But I got cast in this devised piece that is going to be a documentary style, kind of like the Laramie Project. I'm also part of a student theater company on campus called Aeneid Theater Company.
Yeah, you know, you've got a lot going on. Tell us how you first encountered this exercise.
Yes. So, as you mentioned, Victoria, I studied at BADA in 2017. It was their Midsummer Conservatory program, and it was in Oxford. And this was in my Shakespeare text class with Eunice Roberts. And I don't ever think that she gave a formal name to this exercise, which is something that we walked into class. Prior, she said, learn this sonnet. We're going to work on it. If you don't know it, you don't know it. So we get to class and she's like, walk around the space. And she's like, everyone, just say the text. Just get it out of your mouth. You know, just say the words. And so we did that. We keep walking. And then she was like, okay, now go line by line. And this is what I now do in my own work when I come across a classical text. She's like, okay, just now let's just focus on the vowels. So we still said the words, but for example, the first line, if I do count the clock that tells the time, and she's okay, focus on vowels. It's if I count the clock that tells the time, you know. So she was like, just keep like a mental checklist of the words that have more vowels, that have that like softer sound, that force your mouth to open up a little bit more. And then we did it again, but with the consonants. And then I remember she brought out a second sonnet. It was sonnet 129. And she said, okay, now do the same thing. Just get the words out. And then second time, don't go line by line. Just go through the whole thing and really just like accentuate and really like focus on your diction, every single word. And after we did that, she said, okay, what's the difference between, we didn't talk about the meaning of these sonnets. She said, don't look it up, don't Google it, don't do anything like that. But she just said, what's the difference? And we were all like, well, 129 sounds so harsh and so violent and brutal. And she was like, yes. And Shakespeare was using a lot of words with T's and D's and a lot of like really harsh sounds that kind of force you to like grind your teeth a little bit more. And then with sonnet 12, yeah, there are a lot of those more open sounds. If I do count the clock that tells the time and see the brave day sunk in hideous night. We didn't discuss the meaning or anything like that, but she was saying, you know, that is such an important tool that often it's overlooked, because with Shakespeare, your first thought is one, and I need to know what I'm saying, and two, the audience needs to know what I'm saying and what's going on. But Shakespeare really chose his words so carefully. So I've always kind of kept that idea when I've dealt with classical text, especially if I feel stuck. I'm like, hey, let me just get the words out, see what's happening. It does sort of like lay a groundwork for you to play different things and try different things, and it can reveal something about the character. That's the exercise, essentially.
Perrin, tell us what text we're going to be working on and what play it's from.
This is Joan Lapoussel's monologue from Henry VI, Part 1. It's an Act 5, Scene 2 in most versions. Sometimes it's the beat right at Act 5, but I think it's Act 5, Scene 2 in most copies. So this play is based on the Hundred Years' War, England versus France. And here comes this girl from a very, very poor small village in France. She claims that she has these visions, that she can speak to these three angels. Essentially, they said, you know, you are protected by us. You are going to help France win this war. And nothing will happen to you because you will win. And she's like, I need to do this because they told me. And so she goes into France. She speaks to the current prince because he's not crowned king yet. And she says, first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to crown you king. I'm going to win these battles. I'm going to win the war. And he's like, no, you're like 14. And she's like, no, but I have God on my side. Of course, all the men laugh at her. They're like, no, you don't. So then she gets a horse, she gets armor, and she goes. And this is right before she's burned at the stake. So right now, she's on the battlefield. It's like one of the last battles, we can assume, for the war before England wins. Spoiler, England wins. And right after this monologue, she is captured by England, and she is, of course, burned at the stake. Well, she's put on trial first. And then she's burned at the stake because they don't believe her, obviously, because she's tried for witchcraft. Because what she does in this monologue is she conjures some demons from underground because it is her last hope. There's this incredible fear and guilt because she was promised. She was like, the voices, these visions, these angels, they promised me I would win, and it looks like it's not going to happen. So she's like, this is my last resort. I'm going to conjure these demons, and that's the monologue.
Perrin, I'm going to ask you to actually read all the text. I know you had to trim it because when you audition for colleges and summer programs, just for the audience's information, they will often ask you to do a 90-second version, a 60-second version. So let's go ahead and read the full speech, and then we'll go back and kind of play with it a little bit.
Yeah, of course. All righty. The regent conquers and the Frenchmen fly. Now help, ye charming spells and periaps, and ye choice spirits that admonish me and give me signs of future accidents. This speedy and quick appearance argues proof of your accustomed diligence to me. Now, ye familiar spirits that are culled out of the powerful regions under earth, help me this once that France may get the field. Oh, holy not with silence overlong. I was wont to feed you with my blood. I'll lop a member off and give it you in earnest of a further benefit, so you do condescend to help now.
I loved watching you, how your eyes were looking up. Even just through Zoom, you were putting yourself in a subservient position. Like that feeling of being tied down and like looking up at your captor. It was immediately clear.
Yeah, there's so much there. All right, let's start playing with sound. So how would you approach this, exploring the exercise of the sound in the words?
I would just go line by line and just see the kind of sounds that come out. And from there, I just sort of talked myself through it. We have this particular sound. What does that mean for my character and what's happening in the moment? What does that do to me physically? So I just kind of like let myself experience it and then talk about it.
Go for it, Prince. So let's pretend that we're a fly on the wall inside your studio.
Cool. Okay, so I think this first line, the regent conquers and the Frenchman fly, that is, I'm saying what is happening right now. So you have the regent conquer, like that's such a juicy word, conquers. It's like immediately I'm making fists with my hands. Because I'm talking about England. I hate England. They're winning. The regent conquers and the Frenchmen fly. Like immediately my hand just went up for the word fly. I mean, it's a podcast, but yeah, my hand went up because that sound fly, it's again, my it forces my mouth to open. And so you think about that image, the Frenchmen fly. There are, to me, that was always, there are bodies flying. Oh my, and now it like kind of puts something in my chest, that breath, and the Frenchmen fly. It's like I'm almost like physically, I go forward even a little bit, thinking about, you know, a little bit about the context too, of I'm here on this battlefield, it's the last thing and I need to win. I want the audience to pity me a little bit. Look what's happening. And so in terms of an active verb that I can now, because when you're performing on stage, you're not going to obviously be thinking about the sounds of the words. You want to put like an active verb to kind of help bring you to that same place. Maybe a verb can be to guilt, make them feel bad for me, you know, to guilt.
That's interesting, Perrin. It makes me think of when you walk into a room and it's one of the biggest football games and you've had to leave the room for some reason. You got to go do a little bit of work. And when you walk in the room, you go, all right, what's going on? Who's? And so that idea of her saying the regent conquers and the Frenchmen fly is this immediate catch up. Are you taking that moment to get everybody to listen and know where the fight is, to catch everybody up in that moment? Do you want them to pity you and be on your side? You are now going to have to do the thing that is the worst thing you could possibly do as a completely pious person. Let's keep going.
Yeah, so true. I love that. I love that last one because immediately after she says, now help ye charming spells and Periash. So now she says now a lot, which of course for the context of like, I need it done right now. But, you know, now help and help. Yeah, there's an E, there's a vowel, but the P kind of like cuts it off for you. Now help. I can't like elongate the E as compared to like fly or, you know, something like that. But then she says ye charming spells and periaps. So the demons have not, or the fiends, as is written in the text, they have not appeared yet, but she's now in the process of trying to call them, trying to appeal to them. So I think that's where these like softer sounds come in.
I'm just going to contest that a little bit, Perrin, and I think you're going to love this. She does not call to the fiends. She calls to the buddies that she has a relationship with. And she asks them to call the fiends. And then the vowels change and the consonants change and the language changes when she starts to deal with the fiends. So I think that softer stuff is when she's dealing with these spirits, right? They're not fiends, they're spirits that she has a relationship with.
Totally, yes. As you said, she's not calling the fiends now, but she's calling the things that will get the fiend, these other spirits that she's put her trust in. Like when you want to soften someone up of like, hey, can you oh my God, can you get me some water? Like, I'm so thirsty. Like, just not just saying please in this, you know. And she wants to be on their good side even. Like, ye charming spells and periaps, like, you're so beautiful. And the next line, and ye, is a comma, slight breath, choice. Like, I put my trust in you, ye choice spirits that admonish me. Admonish. And the SH sound is always really interesting. So I think, again, we're keeping the same objective. I want these spells to call on the fiends. And how are you going to do that? To get someone to soften up? To grab someone's attention, maybe?
And to flatter, as you said before. You are choice spirits. You've always given me signs of future accidents.
Yeah, totally. And then the last line of this little section, and give me signs of future accidents.
Accidents is a great word that sounds exactly like what it is.
Yeah.
It's like a crunching. It immediately has friction. This section has me thinking a lot about antithesis, not just in the words, but in the sounds. Because usually we refer to antithesis in terms of meaning, but here I'm actually seeing it like ye charming spells and periaps versus give me signs of future accidents is really crunchy. You can tell that she's appealing to a different sphere because there's a lightness and a levity in a lot of the sounds that he's provided. And the words that apply to her present condition are really earthy.
I love that. I never thought about that earthy, like, groundedness. That's so interesting. Okay, so now stage directions. Enter fiends. They've entered.
She accomplishes her first objective.
Yes.
The spirits who she has the relationship with get the fiends, and the fiends show up right there, instantly on the battlefield.
And she says, this speedy and quick appearance argues proof of your accustomed diligence to me.
And in those lines, she's not speaking to the fiends yet. It argues proof, spirits, that you are still loyal to me and I to you. That's really important.
Accustomed diligence felt kind of heavy. That could be interpreted to be many things. The first thought was, we have a past. Like, you have helped me before. And it could even be like a thank you. And that image on the battlefield, and, like, you know, when they, like, grab each other's arms and they're like, thank you. Like, I was about to die. Like, thank you. You're of your accustomed diligence to me.
Paren, it's interesting that you said about thank you, because as you were reading it, I thought exactly that. So if you think about being on the battlefield, and we've all seen these moments in films where you are going to die unless they send the reinforcements. And the person looks back to see if those reinforcements are there. And there's that horrible moment where they are not. In fact, they show up. And so it's that good moment in the film where the reinforcements suddenly come flying down the hill. And you know they're going to win the battle. Well, she doesn't win. But in this moment, she got the reinforcements. And interestingly, speedy, etymologically, it's a Scottish word, it doesn't mean fast. It means helpful. So it's different than quick, but it's this idea of being helpful, of always being at my side, these spirits that you're in communication with.
Yes.
As soon as those reinforcements come in, there's an almost business moment of saying, thank you, okay, everybody, you did it, thank you. And then it shifts where you now have to speak to the troops. Well, in this case, the troops are fiends. And now you have to weirdly do like your St. Crispin's to a bunch of fiends.
Yeah.
And so it's gonna go in a very different way. Go ahead and read these next lines where you're now turned to the fiends. They have a very different sound.
Okay. Now, ye familiar spirits that are culled out of the powerful regions under earth, help me this once, that France may get the field.
What do those sounds feel like to you? It's very different.
Those are words. That was hard for me to say. The stakes are so high and she's running out of time, like, as she's saying this monologue. Ye familiar spirits that are culled. I love that word. Every time I do that, that's like the word I look forward to. That are culled. Like the U, the U and then the double L, like that falls back in my throat. Like you can probably see my neck veins when I say that. That are culled out of the powerful, right? That P, powerful. It's like, it's that like pop sound. Like it goes out, that powerful regions under, again, that like you, the under earth. Again, going with the objective, I want the fiends to listen to my orders and do as I say so that I can win this war. Now it's to energize, to hype them, to prepare them. It's like you are so great that are called out of the powerful regions under earth. Comma, next verse line, help me. Help me this once. And like once, the O-N sound, help me this once. Like to me, that's like to beg. Help me this once. Like just the one, this is the only thing that I will ever ask of you. Help me this once that France may get the field. France naturally just kind of like falls off the tongue. France, that is emotional to her, and she says France many times. She's like, this is my country. It's not that France may earn the field. It's not that France may win. It's France may get. Again, the stakes, it is so high that France may get the field.
And France again feels very like floral versus cold. I think what's striking about this sentence is it feels like you're scooping them out from the under earth with all of the language that you're using. And by saying ye familiar spirits, you're associating yourself with them as well. It's as if all of us have just been torn up like roots from the ground to give France this much more abstract thing leverage.
Yeah, totally. And that could even lead to your physical choices on stage. If you're doing this on stage or in an audition or anything, that, yeah, that like if the sounds make you feel like you are scooping them up, that you are literally like diving into the ground and like pulling them, you could like, that can totally lead to a physical choice.
It also gave me the idea, Perrin, that maybe it's not finished, that they've appeared, but now she has to get them to mobilize. They may actually still be buried up to their knees or whatever, and she has to use her words to get them now to move.
Right. It takes a physical toll on her. Like, with her words, she has to pull them up from the ground. It's like you're like outside in your garden, you look at a flower, and you're like, how do I pull this up without physically pulling it up?
Perrin, before we go on with this speech, what's your relationship with O's in Shakespeare? Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. In any classical text, the O cannot just be, oh, hold me not with silence overlong, or oh, my lord. I mean, it could be, but it's a really emotional thing. Again, like as we both talked about, breath connects you, or it connects me at least, to the rest of my body and my emotions, that when you have the chance to just open your mouth and say, oh, it can lead to so many things, and it's a really, like, I don't want to say it's like a cheat for actors, but it does help to stir some emotion, to kind of like bring you in the moment even. It is very vulnerable, and I've had to do it on stage, and you think about it, and you're like, oh, well, we don't do that in real life. We don't just, like, sit somewhere and, like, let out a sound, but you do. I've had moments where I've done that in my life, where I just, like, sound comes out of me, and it's such a... it's a human thing, and so I think to treat it as just like an OH, I don't think it's enough, especially also because Shakespeare's characters are, any classical characters, they're going through the most. It's either like, I gotta go kill the king, I gotta summon these demons, I am about to die. Like, it is like such high stakes that I think, you know, getting the O, like, you can totally dive into that.
You said something really interesting about how we don't naturally just make sound on our own, because I don't think that we do generally sit in our chairs and go, oh, and like fully release into the Shakespearean O. But I think that says much more about our culture than it does about the impulse to do that and to release. And I hadn't thought of this before, but OM is so similar to O. And if you think of OM in yoga, Buddhism, anything, it's actually the hum of the universe. That's how it's described. It's the sound that the universe makes when it's vibrating, when it's moving. It gives the actors a tremendous and also very scary opportunity to show what release is like in a culture right now that is very restricted and is very anti-release. I was talking a little bit with Victoria before about how going full out with the Shakespearean O and just loudly letting it take up space is often like taking that breath in a yoga class that is very tight and restricted, and being that person that does that exhale first. And it's not awkward because it doesn't feel good, but it's awkward because in the face of other people who haven't allowed themselves to do it yet, it draws attention to you. I think always for me, the solution with something that's that scary is forcing yourself, no matter how attention grabbing it is, to go all the way into the impulse rather than falling it 50%, because it's when people commit to something 50% that it gets cringeworthy, because we want them to fully follow the impulse, because we want to follow our impulses. We want it to be okay. We right. want that full release to be that guiding light for us.
Yeah, that is such a beautiful way to put it. And I think, yeah, when you fully commit to the Shakespearean O, like, I now see this light that is coming from you and reaching to the audience. One of the main purposes of acting is to reach other people, is to reach those audience members and say, like, hey, I'm with you.
The Shakespearean O gets at the very heart of why I do theater, because it's that opening up, because you can't force vulnerability out of any single person. The only thing you can do is just show it in yourself. So if you can genuinely commit to that and be like, hey, I'm opening up my chest so you can see, if you're allowing yourself to play the fool, then other people can feel comfortable allowing themselves to as well. I think it's like I think it's a very cool gift. I think for me, the Shakespearean O at its best is all about allowance, and at its worst is all about tension, making you face your own tension. But two sides of the same coin.
Puren, I'm going to ask you to just read that section of the speech again and just allow yourself to indulge in the sounds.
And this is something I told our other guest, is after we've done all the homework and we've done all the working, trust that it's in your body and you don't have to show us any of it. Just let it all go.
Okay. The regent conquers and the Frenchmen fly. Now help, ye charming spells and parry apps, and ye choice spirits that admonish me, and give me signs of future accidents. This speedy and quick appearance argues proof of your accustomed diligence to me. Now, ye familiar spirits that are culled out of the powerful regions under earth, help me this once, that France may get the field. Oh, hold me not with silence overlong, where I was wont to feed you with my blood. I'll lop a member off and give it you in earnest of a further benefit. So you do condescend to help me now. It's weird to let go, because I'm like, wait, sounds, but yeah, it's there.
It always is. And honestly, the more we trust that it is, the more effortless everything becomes.
Yeah, it's like going to the gym and like working a muscle, and then you show up to the rehearsal room and you try, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You go back, you try. I've done it where I'm like, I tried this and my director was like, I don't think so. Try something else. And I go home and I do a different thing. And letting go is important. It's important to hear that and like tell yourself that, because I forget too, where I get very tense. I'm like, okay, I have to remember the beats and the punctuation and the sounds and the verse line and the this and the this. But sometimes you just need to like trust yourself that if you did the work, it's living somewhere in your brain.
Puren, thank you so much for being with us and for sharing this incredibly important exercise so clearly and beautifully. And best of luck with the devised piece and all of the projects this year.
Thank you so much, Puren.
Yes, thank you. Thank you both. I had an amazing, amazing time.
So that was so interesting for me listening to that episode back, because I think our initial intention was just solely focusing on sound and speech. And Perrin was just so open-hearted about this approach that we ended up going in so many different directions. We ended up covering so much more.
Yeah, we may have to do another episode just on sounds in the speech.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was so classic Perrin, being so curious and fascinated by everything that you just can't keep that woman down. Because, you know, you start with exploring what an R sounds like. And the next thing is you want to know all about it. You want to know the history of the word, the etymology of the word, what it means, why it means this. And so there were just too many places to go. But ultimately, I think we did do what we set out to do, which was to say, this is a tool. And if you take the time to really allow these sounds to start in your mouth, move through your body, and they will give way to idea, character, intention, motivation. And that's why we got a little bit lost, because we started thinking about character, idea, motivation, intention. And why? Because sound gave way to that. So in a way, it's just form and content.
I think that's beautifully said.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening to Coaching Shakespeare. I'm Marissa, the podcast producer and editor. Shout out to the amazing team who helped Victoria, Amanda, and me bring this podcast to life. Jeremy Schinder, our intern, Rachel Miller, and Nora Slonim, our graphic artists, and Nina Oso, our music composer. If you like the episode, we would love for you to rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're streaming. And better yet, tell your friends, classmates, teachers, or colleagues to check out the show. It goes a long way in helping us reach any future listeners. If you really like the episode, you can also subscribe to us on Patreon and get some great perks in exchange for a monthly donation. We also want you to reach out with any of your questions, corrections, or suggestions for the show. To provide that feedback or to inquire about masterclasses or online coaching sessions, visit coachingshakespeare.com and fill out our contact form. In the meantime, we'll exit pursued by a bear.